Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the table. I am your host, Kyle Lira, and joining me today, I have Alexis Soto. How are you doing today, Alexis?
I am here.
Now, you may be asking, what is To the Table if this is your first episode? Now, To the Table is a review show where we, one another, give another person a movie that one another has never seen, and we bring a movie to the table, so to speak, hence the name, To the Table. Today, we have two movies to discuss. Alexis gave me a movie that, shockingly, I have never seen until a couple of weeks ago, or 2 months ago, or something like that. And that is Inception. And I gave Alexis, we're gonna break some ground here. We are doing a movie that was previously discussed on the program. And I'm just dying to know what my fellow co-hosts' thoughts are on the film. Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So, Alexis, who should go first?
Well, we all know you want to get my thoughts on Scott Pilgrim, so we might as well just go with that.
Or we could say best for last and get your thoughts over with. And I cover Inception, and then you go over Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So, I think that would be good because I think there'll be I want to get that Polka conversation over with first before we dive into the delicious dessert, you know. So unless you want to go first, Scott Pilgrim.
I don't care.
You don't care? Okay. I don't care. Okay. Alexis, I must ask you, why did you give me Inception?
Because it was a movie you haven't seen before, and you seem to be you seem to like Christopher Nolan based on his the works that you have seen, mm-hmm. and this is a very Nolan film, and if I recall correctly, this was my very first Christopher Nolan movie.
Really?
And, interesting. I really like this movie. I really, really enjoy this film. And I think it was one that I really gained favor with me on, you know, multiple viewings of it. I just think it's a really imaginative film. And I think it's a great ride. I really appreciate that. I think it's obviously a brilliant film in terms of like the caliber that's behind the camera, with the direction and the cinematography and the acting and the writing and, of course, the visuals. And, of course, when you've seen this movie, are mm-hmm. we being interrupted? What's that? What's
no.
that noise?
No, you're good.
Okay. If you've seen this movie, which you have, you can tell that this is where everybody was, like, looking to when Doctor Strange was coming out and they had those trailers of the Folding City as well.
Yeah.
In part, this is where that comes from. So
a little bit of it.
Right.
Yeah. First off, I want to address that I really enjoyed it. I really thought that it was a kick-ass film. It really did a lot of things right. Going into the movie, like, I, you know, a lot of people point to this as, like, the big mind-blowing movie, you know, and everybody, like, points out to me, like, you know, oh, this, like, you know, completely changed the aesthetic plane of, you know,
well,
all of reality.
Careful. And be careful with hype, because hype can be a bitch.
I was like, okay, you know, I'll see what you guys mean. If I were around the time that this movie came out and saw it when it came out, I would completely get the hype. I would completely.
Well, Kyle, you were around. What do you mean you weren't around?
I know, but when I was there when the movie came out, like, there, you know, were you there when Inception came out? if I were around, I would get the hype, you know, because they do a lot of interesting things with, like, reality, conceptualizing, you know, dreams and, like, you know, going into dreams within dreams. It's very, you know, Edgar Allan Poe-esque, you know, like the concept of a dream within a dream kind of thing. And, like, the way that they tackle this in such a, like, fascinating manner, I think that they really, really stepped up their A game, and Christopher Nolan, my God, I think that I don't think it's a controversial opinion. I think that this has got to be the most gorgeous film that Nolan has done. Wait, no, that could be a controversial opinion, because a lot of people dig the living shit out of Interstellar. So I don't know. I think number one, I think that it's the most gorgeous Nolan film ever. But anyway, when the movie came out and everything, I where was I when this movie came out? Like, where, how come it took me so long to see this movie? Because, you know, given, you know, put me in the backscape of, like, when I was like 12 or, you know, 13 when this movie came out, you know, which I feel like a dinosaur just saying that. It really felt like this is something that could have, like, broadened my mind in terms of, like, cinematography, film.
You know, this came out in 2010, right?
Yeah. It's such a strange world, you know, 2010. And this is like post Dark Knight, right? And this is like when everybody was like, when Christopher Nolan was a household name.
Yeah. It was.
I find that fascinating. Let's get into the cast. Leo DiCaprio, I think he was really good as Cobb. I think that's his name, Cobb. And he really portrayed, like, you know, you could tell that, you know, he has a lot of secrets. I think it's safe to say that Leonardo DiCaprio is the Robert Redford of our time. You know, he has this way of acting, and the way that, you know, he doesn't wear, you know, he lets the character speak for itself, you know, and makes the character, you know, he shrouds his characters in mystery. The way he fluctuates, you know, the way that he, you know, emotes. And I think that he does a really good job, you know, and he's probably one of the best actors working in our time. And this, what he did with Cobb, I think, was really interesting, because, you know, he does have a past, especially when it leaves up to the ending of the film. I mean, there's ambiguity there, which has been, like, one of the most debated things in cinema history, you know? So I think a lot of stuff that happens with Cobb and everything like that is really, really nice and well put and well said. And I think that his character is, like, probably the most interesting in terms of, like, where Nolan's characters come from. I would probably say that if it weren't for, like, you know, the comic book aspect, because it wasn't a Nolan created character, I would say Batman probably, because of his whole morale stance. But I think that that this is a really good Nolan character. And I was like, when I got to the credits, it said written and directed by Christopher Nolan, because I had no idea that he wrote it himself. I thought it was Jonathan Nolan, his brother, because he always writes the scripts and everything like that. So I thought that this was a Jonathan Nolan thing, and I'm like, this Jonathan, you're doing wonders. But then the credits came on and it said written by Christopher Nolan, and I was like, wow, you had your cake and ate it too, kind of thing. And it from opening shot to, you know, the waves, and I was like, wow, breathtaking. You know, the way it started off with waves and going on from there, you know, the whole, like, escape situation from Ken Watanabe's men and everything like that. Really interesting. There's a little bit of intrigue with Marion Cotillard's character, and the way that it progresses from there. It's a really well-paced movie. It's a two and a half hour movie, but it feels like it's an hour. You know, it's much like the concept of the dream. You know, you're in the world, and, you know, what may be like 5 minutes is like an hour. In terms of, like, the terms of the movie. So I think that a lot of interesting development happened throughout the entire movie to keep me going and to keep me guessing. I didn't really know where the things is going. You know, I was like, okay, oh, we jumped into another dream. Okay, we're doing that. Oh, wait, that dream was actually reality when this was, I mean, there's so many cross-grained moments throughout the entire movie that kept me going, kept me interested. And it was just a mind numbing in the best way possible. It's mind numbing in the best way possible. That's the way I could describe this movie. So yeah. That's a lot of this movie is definitely a lot to take in.
It is.
That's what I could say.
Because it intentionally fucks with your mind. It fucks with your perception of reality. And then you question things. And I think one of the and people have their own interpretations, obviously, about this, but I think that's what makes the ending, I think, really great, is you don't really know where he is in the end. You know?
Yeah.
When the little knob thing falls, I mean, I myself still don't really know what the ending is, but I haven't really gone
out of your way to find the answers.
Exactly, because I think that's just really a satisfying ending. I like to think that he got out and then that was the ending. But if he didn't, well, that's also a really interesting ending. So,
Nolan, like I was like doing my homework on the film as you know, as a prepared podcaster would. Nolan said that, you know, he pretty much said in like fancy terms, who the fuck cares? and he gets that question, like, did Cobb, you know, make it into reality at the end? And there's a couple clues that hint that he is in reality. It's just funny how like that is like the most questioned aspect of his film career. What's up with the Inception ending, you know? So I think that's that, you know, even still to this day he still gets that same question, you know, and it's a lasting impact that you know, this movie came out in 2010, and the lasting impact that the movie has had since then is brilliant, you know. It's just, it has a brilliant, like, you know, edge to it, you know. I don't know what is, like, the best non-Batman Nolan film ever, you know. A lot of people say it's Interstellar. A lot of people say Inception.
Some people say Dunkirk. So, honestly, I don't think you saw it yet, but, like, and this is when Peter and I went to go see it. And even in the aftermath of the Oscars, people really declared Dunkirk as the Christopher best. Nolan's magnum opus. I'm not kidding you. And I think for me and Peter, that's like easily the most disposable Nolan film. I think technically speaking, it is a masterwork of a film, Dunkirk. And I believe there's a review on it somewhere for the people who want to listen to it on the feed from a year and a half ago. So if you want to go listen to that.
Somewhere. But,
over the rainbow. But yeah, I don't know. For me, I think Inception clearly is what Christopher Nolan is down to a science. I think it is, for me anyway, the definitive Nolan film and my favorite Nolan film. Not
really.
The Dark Knight notwithstanding, because of course The Dark Knight is an amazing film. I think those two are neck and neck for me.
You know? I think when discussing Nolan films, I think we should just put The Dark Knight aside.
That's what I'm saying.
Because like there's no comparison. It's like not only
besides in personal, there's a Batman superhero bias in there somewhere. So it's like, yeah. You know, it's best to like, and like there's also two other, I mean, Batman movies that he made, but you know, The Dark Knight is like regarded as one of the best films of the past of this century, really.
Yeah.
So it's really a hard thing to live up to that. But I really think with every film, Christopher Nolan has really shown yet again that he is an auteur, that he is somebody that pleasures in doing something completely different than what he did last time. There are similarities and tendencies with him in his films that we've noticed, and cinematography being one thing, and then obviously
him hiring
That would be with his insistence of hiring Hans Zimmer, which speaks more to Hans Zimmer than it does to speak to Christopher Nolan. I do not want to touch that. I mean,
That's like, a whole podcast all in itself.
That would be its own thing, but I really do think this is a brilliant film, and I think one of the earliest films, going back to 2010, that really, I think, piqued my imagination into what films could be. It really kind of was a gateway film, if you will, to other kinds of different really interesting and crazy out there films.
The way that Inception was to you is the way that Star Wars is to me. Like how...
Well,
Like how, like, oh, this is how, this is what films are, like the quote unquote film, you know.
I would say yes and no, because I wouldn't regard my love for Inception as equal to your love for Star Wars or my own love for Star Wars.
Oh,
but the comparison does stand, though, that it is a gateway movie. It is a gateway movie. And it does show you the kinds of things that film can be. So, yes, that comparison does stand, although I don't want to get people the wrong perception here. It's like Inception's not like one of my top 10 movies. I think it's in my top 50 for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely, I think, opened the door to a whole new area of movies that I previously wouldn't have bothered to have seen before.
Or dealt with. Or,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So. It has its fair share of like good moments. The action scenes throughout the entire movie are spectacular, which begs the question like of how like the thing's gone. Why hasn't Nolan done a Bond film yet?
I just had realized that was gonna come next. I do want to touch though is if I remember correctly, and keep in mind that I think at this point it had been some time that I hadn't seen Inception. But I do know that this was one of the last Hans Zimmer scores that wasn't
heavy
the entire time. That there was actually, I think the character that he created for the composition of this movie really fit the tone of it. And I have
especially
to
leading up to the climax of the film.
Yes,
it was gorgeous.
And keep in mind again, this being 2010, you have like Tom Hardy and Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Ellen Page who weren't nearly as huge as they are right now.
Yeah.
And also, I think this is one of like their – this was if you go and ask them, this would be one of the first films in their careers that really helped them like launch off.
That in terms of like what Ellen Page did, Juno is a huge film that she did.
X-Men Days of Future Past was obviously an X from that. But I think she was an X-Men before that movie. If I recall correctly, she was an X2 or X3, one of those things. Way before, or was she?
I think her first appearance was in Last Stand.
The Last Stand, right? Yeah. And then she came back for Days of Future Past. And then of course Gordon-Levitt was there for the next film. He was in Dark Knight Rises, which I think he was quite good. And I think he's good in almost anything he does.
As Robin. Course,
yes, and then Tom Hardy, of course. Fucking Tom Hardy. I mean, what was the next thing he did? Bane? I'm pretty sure. There it is. There it is. There. Yeah, we all saw that coming.
It's such a shit show.
I mean, we want to laugh at it, but I mean, look, if we go back and revisit The Dark Knight Rises, it is hardly a shit show compared to some things that we've seen in recent days.
I've gone on record saying I'd choose a wonderfully bad movie than a good boring movie. I think we need to
dig that up and relitigate that because I don't recall it being a shit show. I recall it being okay. There was good moments in that film, but
unfortunately, I think what happened was
Heath Ledger died.
The death of Heath Ledger really bogged down the story of what 3 could have been.
It never fucking fails. Every time a big high profile star leaves, it usually spells end. It happened when Charlie Sheen was fired off 2.5 Men.
Uh-huh.
It happened when Kevin Spacey was found out to be a sexual deviant. And he was fired off House of Cards. Literally, when it comes to virtually every single instance in which a major star is like gone, it just isn't the same. The one exception that I've seen in either television or film is the Connors. The Connors seems to be moving on just fine without Roseanne. Mm-hmm. Good for them.
Thank God for them, man. I feel I felt bad for, I didn't feel bad for Roseanne. I just felt bad for the cast. I'm like,
Laurie Metcalf and John Goodman. Like, what the hell?
Sarah Gilbert. I mean, everybody in that show, yeah. You know, I just like, I caught the first two episodes of The Conners, by the way.
Right. And they're just fine, right? They're fine without
her. Enjoyable. They're yeah. good quality content. So I think that, you know, I felt really bad for the Conners and everything like that. But no, Heath had to go method, but I think it's like a law of diminishing returns. You know, you give out one of the best performances in the past century in film.
Yeah, literally.
And comes that, you know, it had to cost something in the end. So I think, you know, it sucks, but if it led to the Dark Knight, then, because you can't go into the Dark Knight and just say, oh, it's all Nolan. No, I don't think the movie would be as good if Ledger wasn't involved with the film at all. So I think that this is like a true testament. Like, what could Nolan bring to the table? And Inception is a huge, huge answer to that.
Plus, Leo is just a great actor in anything he does. I think this is one of my favorite Leo movies. If I think of my favorite Leo movies, I think of this one, or at least performances. I think of this and also Jordan Belfort in Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
He's also great in Django Unchained.
That's really good.
Oh, and while The Revenant is kind of a big, like, depressing, dour pill that you have to swallow,
uh-huh.
It's a beautifully made movie. It's a beautiful. You've seen The Revenant, right? You haven't seen The Revenant. Oh, okay. Well, that might be one we do. Okay. Well, it's interesting. But you have seen Wolf of Wall Street, Django yeah, Unchained, and also what was the other one? And this one.
He was great in J. Edgar. He was really good in
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah. I really love Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet.
That's a film.
That is, you know, say what you will about the batshit nature of that film. I adore that film. It's probably my favorite Baz Luhrmann film.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't he also do that Great Gatsby movie with him?
He did The Great Gatsby, which also another great performance. I think that's why I said that he's probably the Robert Redford of our time, because Redford played Gatsby before. But no, because he's like,
Catch Me If You Can. He's fun.
Catch Me If You Can. That's great. Well, of course, we can't talk about Leo DiCaprio without talking about Titanic, you know.
And, oh, shit.
And he was great as Jack Dawson. Jack, paint me like one of your French girls.
That's not what I. Okay, no.
Hey, you forgot all of Billy Zane's eyeliner budget. But I think there's a lot of good, great performances that, you know, The Revenant was pretty much that Oscar, like, the Academy Award board, like, saying, fine, here.
That's every Academy Award ever.
Yeah.
Either they really like you, or they're forced to give you an award after years and years of great performances. It's one or the other.
They're like, fine.
Like this year, when Black Panther will win Best Picture. By the way, Peter and I have, like, confirmed our predictions. Black Panther is getting in for Best Picture. So
God.
Be prepared for that. It's not even a question.
I want to iterate for Red Spot Entertainment. It's not the fact that there's representation in the movie. That is a great fucking thing. But where you confuse, you know, representation over quality, that's where you draw the line. You know, yeah. So that's our stance on Black Panther. But anyway, Inception, great film. There's so much to talk about and delve into in terms of, like, what Inception is and what it, you know, it can
be. Did you make of the concepts that were being discussed? Because I think a big a really interesting question, because, you know, we on the show, we really we try and cover the perception, or not maybe not the perception, but the taste, if you will, and desires that a general audience goes to go see movies. And I wonder, do you feel that they explained the concepts of this film as far as the dream within a dream to a point that the general audience would like? Or maybe just fuck the general audience. Did you understand what was going on half
well,
the time?
Well, I think the numbers speak for itself. I think like 836.3 million at the box office speaks for, you know, how much everybody got it and like their minds were blown.
You're kidding me. It made that much money.
It made that much money, yeah.
You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding you.
That feels like a different world, because I don't think that would have made that much money today.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, okay, $828.3 million at the box office.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I mean, the only thing I might think at that point what drove that is that was after
Dark
Nolan
Knight.
Became a household name.
Yeah.
Because of The Dark Knight. So that might be driving that.
Plus, you had powerhouse performances and powerhouse, like, you know, actors.
Yeah, but that may be more of correct. That all contributed. Leo contributed. But I think Nolan really has become a powerhouse unto his own. We can't – I shouldn't have been surprised, because both Interstellar and Dunkirk were huge, massive successes at the box office. Mm-hmm. Like, the only original films I think succeed nowadays is if you have a big name attached to it. And, I mean, a really, really big name, because –
because other than that,
well, yeah, I mean, poor Scorsese and Spielberg, unless they're doing like tent poles or properties, they're not making much money these days.
And, you know, it's just like a lot of people complain that, you know, oh, you know, where's the creative films? There's no such thing as creative films anymore. Well, you're not going to pay to go see the creative films anymore. That's why.
And that's why they're not making them.
And that's why the focus groups are not like, that's why the focus groups are like more into trying to make a franchise film than trying to make a film of this caliber and what Inception is, you know, because I guarantee you, as big as it is then, Inception would not make it in today's film.
But you know, exactly. But let's just say if it did, knowing the nature of studios nowadays and also knowing how... Honestly, it might not even take it anymore. But if Nolan didn't have the control he does right now, and if Interstellar did what it did, like, they would be, oh yeah, sequel. We gotta go back, and we gotta rethink the wheel, and we gotta like explain what the ending was, which will introduce a further character, which will lead into another movie and
spinoff deals. 10-picture deal on Netflix. Let's
a streaming show.
A streaming show. A clothing line.
We'll have a comic book series that will fill in the gaps between movies.
We gotta have the Inception cooking.
We got to spin off Tom Hardy and Gordon Levitt and Ellen Page into their own spin-offs, and
yes,
then because they're big stars now, and then we'll have a superhero crossover finale.
We got to put it all in one thing. We got to, you know, blow our load as soon as we can. Money is, you know, time is money. Money is power. Power is pizza. Let's go, guys.
And that's how every executive thinks ever.
Boom.
So, literally. So, look, I think Inception is a great film. I love it. Mm-hmm. Just talking about it makes me want to go see it back now again. Maybe I will this winter break. But go see it if you haven't. And if you haven't, go and see it again. I think it's one of those films. I think, look, it really is what Nolan does best when he makes a movie. It creates an atmosphere, an environment. It paints a picture. It tells a story visually and then also audibly. And it also, at the end of the day, creates a film that in itself creates an environment for conversation.
Yeah,
after
a wide
conversation.
Variety of conversation. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And honestly, there has yet to be a movie he's made that has failed to do that. Every movie he makes, regardless of how we feel one way or the other, creates a back and forth conversation.
Yeah. So, Inception. Yeah.
Deception. That's the sequel. That would be the sequel.
Deception. Oh my God. We cracked the code, guys. We've done it.
Let's get Ron Howard on it. Let's get Ron Howard to do Deception.
This is Deception Development.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Let's talk about Scott Pilgrim. Let's go to Canada and talk about Scott Pilgrim.
Okay. All right. Let's just get this out of the way with. Why did you want me to see this movie?
Oh, because mostly the reason why I wanted you to see this movie was for curiosity's sake. I was given this movie from To the Table way back when. Earlier this year, which feels like we're in Inception. it's been too fucking long. This year has it flew by, you know, so fucking fast. But then you come like 2018, and it feels like Black Panther came out 10 years ago. I mean, it's just like that's how. I mean, it's just like this weird mindfuck of a year, 2018.
It's like we're in a time warp.
Let's do the time warp again. I gave you this movie because I absolutely fell in love with this film. Like, from the first frame, like, all it took was just seeing the 8-bit intro for Universal Studios. And I was like, what the shit is this? You know, in comes a world, you know, and it says, like, you know, in the magical world of Toronto, Canada. And it was just like insane, quirky, like witty. It had like a lot of things that spoke to me. The layers and levels of this movie.
What about this spoke to you? Tell me, kid. Stripping this movie back, what about this movie like made you love it? Is it the fact that there was video games? Is it the fact that there was rock bands?
I'm not.
Is it the fact that there was like quick comedy out like really fast paced comedy?
That was the frosting of the cake. That was the frosting of the cake. What it really dove down to is that, you know, I keep on thinking about that movie and I keep on finding new things to, you know, point out and like love about it. I keep on coming back to the film with new things to love, new things to admire, new things to cherish. And I think that, you know, right after I saw it, you know, because I saw it in digital form first, Scott Pilgrim, and after I saw the movie, I went and got it in a physical form, you know, because I was like, okay, I need to see this, you know, I need to have it, obtain it, you know, and I think that immediately it jumped into my not even 50 top 10, not top 50 films, like probably top 20 Scott Pilgrim, just because like it's just like I could watch, like the watchability factor of this movie is so vast and so meticulous that I keep on finding new things to love and enjoy and admire, and that's the wonders of an Edgar Wright film. You watch a movie and like there's multiple layers, multiple facets of a film and multiple tears that you find, and it makes you fall in love over and over and over again with the movie. I was semi-watching the movie with you yesterday, like just hearing the audio in the background just made me, you know, I was like, oh, I remember this part. And then I thought about like other things that, you know, some dialogue meant, and there it's just a, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving is the way I could describe it to you, you know. And it really, you know, no more words. It's just a movie that I find that I love over and over and over again. So I was like, is it just me? Am I like just crazy in love with this film?
It's not, because Peter also loves this movie.
Yeah, and so I'm like, am I blinded by my love for this movie? I wanted somebody who probably doesn't give a shit about like the way that this kind of film would be made. And I wanted like an outside opinion. And I'm like, okay, let's get somebody who doesn't normally go for the batshit insane films. And like, let's get like a more level head, you know, in terms of like palettes, film tasting palettes, you know. And I thought, Alexis, let's get Alexis on board and, you know, talk about the film. So that's
well, that being said, though, it's what about this movie did you think would appeal to me in any way?
You see, that's the problem. I didn't know. I was like, what would somebody like Alexis think of this film? You know, somebody mm-hmm. who doesn't normally go for the bombastic sort of film, you know? And I just, the reason it had nothing to do with like, oh, this would appeal to Alexis. It's just, I just generally want to know what the fuck you think of this. Like, somebody with a more sane mind, you know, I want to know what somebody with your mind thought of the film. And that's, again, peeling back the layers of the reason why I want you to see this movie, it's just for fucking curiosity's sake. So I was like, that's what was killing me. I was like, what would, like, you know, I'm insane. I'm an insane person. So this movie draws me. What does somebody who's like more level-headed think of this film? And like that's what was killing me this entire time. Like, what would somebody like with more what would Alexis think? That's pretty much like what I thought. So here we are reviewing Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Alexis, what do you think of Scott Pilgrim versus the World?
Well, you know what? It's very interesting because I don't know if I agree with that characterization, because if anything, because after seeing the film, I really went out of my way to do some more research on it, and in particular, to see how this movie was being received. I watched old reviews, I watched newer reviews, and it certainly just seemed to me, and that also includes the very wonderful review that you and Peter did for To the Table a few months back. I definitely think that this is a beloved, cherished, and celebrated film on virtually every level. And
it's shocking because this was a box office bomb.
Well, I think what Peter said, I think rings true that this was definitely years before its time. If I'm not mistaken, Scott Pilgrim did come out at the same time as what's it called, Inception. But here's my viewing as far as why it wasn't so successful.
Mm-hmm.
I still think, and to be quite honest with you, I still think this movie wouldn't be that much more successful than it was box office wise. But that's not to say that it wouldn't have a bigger audience. It has a huge international worldwide audience, and the film that it is, and given Edgar Wright's name, it definitely would have a much bigger audience now, and a much more passionate and vocal audience. Mm-hmm. I don't know how successful this would be at the box office, but I think this would be a monumental streaming.
You're talking about like a modern day film, film climate, right?
No, I'm talking about the general audience.
I know, but like,
I don't
like
think the general audience,
today's general audience, like, you don't think that it would be, you don't think it'll do any different?
No, I think it would be even worse, to be honest with you. I think this would really turn people off in the worst way possible, because personally speaking, I just think a lot of general audience people are just stick in the muds, and I don't think this. I'll be front with you. I think this film goes hand in hand with the Rocky Horror Picture Show as one of the most outlandish and balls to wall crazy movies I've seen in my life. That's not a bad thing, to be clear about that, because I actually did enjoy Rocky Horror Picture Show for a variety of reasons.
I'm so freaking, I keep on saying this, but I'm freaking jealous that was your first experience watching it in the in the theater, you know, with the interactivity going on. What a way to get introduced to the batshit insanity that is Rocky Horror Picture Show, but to be thrown more batshit insanity.
I do want to clarify, though, is that I do think that this would make more money at the box office, considering how the comic book superhero age has really changed the whole thing.
And this,
I don't know how much more it would play than a Kick-Ass would. You know, I think there's a limited audience there, because while I just don't think general audiences would really think all that much to go see this. However, if this movie nowadays would have landed on streamers, like on a Hulu or a Netflix, my God, would it be a huge hit? Would it be an amazing? Because I think this is the kind of movie that really is made of the streaming age, more so than people will go out and spend money for it. But regardless of that, that has nothing at all to do with the film's quality. And to be quite honest with you, look, I am a fan of Edgar Wright. I did go and see Baby Driver, and I quite enjoyed Baby Driver. I own the film on Blu-ray. I thought it had great performances. I think it was a great written story. And I think what that film featured was definitely a very stylish director, and a director that was talented with a script and a screenplay. Which, again, and while I haven't seen two-thirds, I guess, of the Cornetto trilogy, I have seen Hot Fuzz, because that was one of those firm films that you shown to me years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Hot Fuzz is something that I also would compare to what my experience was with Scott Pilgrim. While, objectively speaking, it is a really great film in so many respects, with great performances and great writing and witty humor bouncing off the walls, ricocheting left and right. Hot Fuzz is not one of those films that I really think all back too much on. And I think that may have to do with the fact that for whatever reason, it's just not my kind of humor. You know, and while there were moments of it that were, I think, made me laugh, overall, mm-hmm. I don't know if it was that kind of dry British humor that may have, you know.
Probably, because I adore dry British humor.
And you know what? I tolerate it, but I don't really. I get it. It doesn't really make me laugh. So okay. That's not really the kind of humor that I appreciate. So that's
my feeling. I mean, some people are American Office. Some people are the British Office.
Yeah.
You're more of the vein of like an American office, and I'm more of the vein of the British office.
Probably so.
So yeah.
And as far as my feelings about Scott Pilgrim versus the World, what I see is something to appreciate in spades. As far as characterization, as far as characters, as far as just the unique identity onto its own that this film has in such a shameless and in such a confidence that it has to itself. Like, Edgar Wright had a vision with this movie, and God, did he really, really land with it as far as he could and then some. This was unlike anything I've seen, really, and it also is something that I just wasn't really expecting from this movie. But that being said, it is one of those movies that was just constantly and constantly over the years brought up as just an amazing thing and just like this really crazy. And I can see why. I can definitely see why this generation in particular loves that. And not just for the pop culture stuff, but because I think it's also an execution that is, and I think it's okay to call this a video game movie.
Yeah, because it's very based into, like, you know, video game culture. And
it is also based off a graphic novel.
Yeah.
So it is this really weird tissue that it connects with video games and with comic books. So I think it can be considered one or the other or both. But as far as video game movies, clearly, just by quality alone, just by writing alone and visuals and just the deliberate execution of a brilliant director guiding this ship, it is without question the most successful and the best video game movie I think that has been produced. That's not saying much, but and while Ready Player One I think is also in that superior category, I don't care for the movie. Mm-hmm. I don't really get angry at it the way Peter does because of the whole fanboy things.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly with you, I didn't really pick up on that when I watched it. But then again, I could barely pick up my own pulse while watching the movie, so there's that. But the thing about this movie is you're never bored. And I think my experience boiling it down is just I was just constantly bewildered at what was going on. And I was just trying to constantly settle in with the groove of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would, something would happen out of left field that really just, okay, that's happening now.
Take you for a ride.
Yeah.
Let's get into characters. Let's talk about Scott Pilgrim himself. What was your reception towards his character? Because he is a lot of people put it in terms of like literacy. He is by definition anti-hero. And the way that he's like not motivated about anything. He doesn't make any choices of his own until like mm-hmm. the very end of the film, because he's usually turning to other people to make decisions for him. You know, his mindset is, you know, like, oh, if I, you know, if I get a girl, you know, my dream girl, everything will be made in the shade. You know, I don't have to do anything, you know, in terms of everything like that. So, you know, and because of his like, you know, negligence in terms of that, he constantly flows through the entire movie, and he drifts until something thrusts, you know, upon his lap, and he, you know, he has to, you know, take action for himself. And a lot of people say that he's like a huge piece of shit. For the way he treats a lot of characters and the way that his persona, you know, lanced upon itself and everything like that. So, what is your take on Scott Pilgrim himself?
There is so much. There's really some like a variety of ways I can tackle. But talking about Scott Pilgrim, I can see why a lot of people feel that way about him, and putting him in the whole. And yes, he is he fits in the lane of anti-hero. But I really don't like him, like, at all. And, you know, it's like, and I guess that may just really, you know, speak to the film overall, but it's like nothing about that situation has any significance to me. Nothing about him being a complete asshole and douchebag to the people, to his friends that he treats, and him falling for a girl while he's dating somebody who really is being nothing but sweet and kind to him. I understand that's the story. I understand that's how things are set up and that's who he is as a character.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean I have to like him. And at no point in this movie did I ever think to myself, I care very much for this person. And at no point did I ever feel bad for him. Especially when what's at stake is just so trivial to me in comparison to other things. I mean, if you just ask me, I think the entire ordeal that he has to go through, while this whole concept of the exes is executed to perfection.
Yeah.
It is hard for me to take any of it seriously because I just didn't care, quite frankly. I just don't care. I don't care about him, and I don't care about what happens to any of these people because none of these people, I think, really appealed to me as human beings that I would that I myself would choose to hang out with. The fact that this entire film is boiled down to whether or not, I like this girl, but this girl's also nice, I guess. It really, I think, does the whole idea of an anti-hero really, like, just injustice, because there are so many anti-heroes that we have really explored in pop culture over the years that are much more likable, lovable even, and exciting. And, you know, I like Michael Cera, but I don't know if there was just something that was just off-putting about him throughout the entire time. And I just don't like him. I just really, really don't like him.
I think that was the point of the film. That he.
I agree with you. That was the point. But that didn't really help anything really for me.
And it's poetic, not irony, but like justice, whatever term you want to use. How he winds up falling for Ramona Flowers, who also in herself is a little bit toxic and everything. It's just like two toxic people falling for each other, you know, and that's,
mm-hmm.
and that's a huge thing. Like she, throughout the entire movie, you know, she, when she first, okay, let's talk about that awkward scene when she first meets Knives. She obviously knows what's happening and she obviously, you know, gets the gist of what's going on. But she's like, eh, about it, because at that point, Scott was just another number to her. And that's the way that she's treated all of her exes, you know, is that, you know, her exes were just another number. And so it's like, it's the perfect, foil slash, you know, romantic interest for Scott, you know, two pieces of shit falling in love with each other, you know, and which begs the question for you, Alexis, what did you think of Ramona Flowers?
Yeah, she's a complicated girl, and she really, you know, there are a number of characters, her and obviously Knives being among them, that the film sets up as being sympathetic towards. But again, she just reminds me like one of those people that doesn't really deal with their problems. And just like because of the shit that they've been through, doesn't really know how to deal with them, and she just runs away from them instead of actually dealing with them, mm-hmm. and inadvertently hurts people along the way. And I mean, I feel like I'm going to be saying this all the way, but it's like, I get that's her character. I get that's what's supposed to happen. I understand it all. But it's, again, it's like, it's hard for me to care about somebody like that. I think the performance was definitely good, and I do think she's likable enough, but
can't say that about Scott Pilgrim though.
Especially when you're comparing the two. But yeah,
I mean, there was a couple of moments where I really liked Scott, like after the whole fight with Todd, I think that's his name, after the whole Todd thing, because his big ex was Envy Adams, and after that whole exchange, like, you know, you made my boyfriend burst and everything like that, and he's like, it's like something like to the vein of, it's okay, Nat, and everything like that, because her name was like, you know, Natalie.
Yeah, you know before. What? I need to address that, because I heard that last at the table, and Peter was really like, he had this whole tangent about Herbie wanting to commit suicide, and then that whole about the Love Bug, the film that you guys reviewed with this movie last time, and he went on this whole thing about, so if a car has the comprehension of suicide, you know how Peter gets that way when he has all these bunch of questions that really mean nothing in the end?
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, this happened with me here.
So I put that out there before I'm attacked by the hyenas about having this issue. But again, at the core of this movie, it's really hard for me to take any of it seriously for a number of reasons. None the least of which is people just die here. And like no one questions
With
that.
like no consequences.
No consequences. And I'm just supposed to be okay with that. I'm like, I mean, I can, I buy that that's what the movie is selling. And again, it's not so much as a criticism of the movie because it really isn't. It's just a reasoning for why it was just so hard for me to connect with really anything of what was going on because I just took none of it seriously.
It's
None of it was any, of any consequence, and I cared for little of what was going on.
it's a pseudo video game reality thing.
Yeah, I got that. I got that. And well, okay. And it definitely it was evoking an actual video game. I mean, that first sequence where the first X bursts in, and
Matthew Patel.
when there's a fight going on, and then he's singing, and then people die inadvertently through that altercation, and I'm like, what the fuck am I watching?
This, okay, you're addressing these issues, and this is like half of the reason why I wanted you
Yeah.
to see this
Because,
movie.
and that's really why I wonder, like, what about this did you think would appeal to me? And then I think to myself, well, okay. I've never really cared for video games.
Okay.
So that's one reason why I didn't care for any of this or why none of this really appealed to me. Don't really care much for rock bands. While the soundtrack objectively is great, especially if you like that music, it kind of became grating for me and obnoxious in areas to the point where I wanted to put it on mute because it's like, I guess if you're into that, which I know you are, and what I'm sure Peter is, for me, it just sounded like they were just playing the same song on repeat throughout the entire film. And that may have been because I was just trying to really understand what in the world this movie was. Again, to be clear, I was never angry at the movie. I was never hating it. I was just not ever caring about it or liking it all that much. What I do like about the film is the balls that clearly are attached to this movie by Edgar Wright. And I love that his voice is oozing throughout every nook and cranny of this movie. And I applaud that. And I'm thankful for that. And quite frankly, we need more of this kind of film out there. If you were to ask me right now what my overall feelings about this is, I don't know really what to make of this movie. I can't hate it. I can't like it. I just don't know what to do about this movie. I'm at a place
You're
where
confused.
it's like purgatory. You know, I'm a Catholic. I'm in purgatory, and I'm really just trying to find my way. I mean, I'm happy people like it, but it's like I'm also at the point where it's like, well, what's the big deal? Well, okay, people like this stuff, but I don't like this stuff. It's not a bad movie, but I don't like it.
Oh I think I've cracked the code, guys. I think I broke Alexis mentally. This is truly a special episode. This is truly a special episode.
I mean, the most that I can crack it down to is that this is objectively an amazing movie, a great work of art, and a 100% unadulterated interpretation of a story from an auteur. That's just not for me. It's in that category of films that, while I can respect it immensely for its
for
its grandiose nature and its confidence. It's not really something I would ever see myself going back to revisit.
Okay.
It's not something that's for me.
And that's why I gave you this movie, because it's like, I know it's not for you, but I just want to know what you think of it as like a film, you know.
I mean, it's just one of the things that confounds me is that everyone seems to be agreed that it's great and they love it to death, and I'm like, okay.
Also, you know, considering the cast that's, you know, done, I don't think that you would have gotten the same cast, you know, if, you know,
no, of course not.
Because a lot of these people in the film have gone to, you know, greater things. I mean, you have, let's just list off the huge cast list. Michael Cera has done wonderful things, you know. Aubrey Plaza, you know, obviously she's like huge in like the independent film circuit. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Chris Evans, Brie Larson, everybody in this film would not be in this film, you know, because there's this huge, you know, cast, A-list cast list that, you know, it's kind of a miracle that, you know, they got them, Edgar Wright got them at this point in their careers, you know. And I think that's also another huge temple. I mean, he pretty much made Simon Pegg a household name. You know, so that's the kind of things that we're dealing with at, you know, at the time and everything. And I think that I think Edgar Wright, you know, he was just a long-haired Brit with the, you know, with the suitcase and a dream, and he made that dream a reality with this film. And this is like, I think that this movie was the movie that put him, you know, into like a worldwide like in terms of like the critic's eye. This is the one that, you know, that put his name on the, you know, on the filmmaking map, you know. Without this, we would not be getting the Cornetto trilogy. We would not be getting, you know, Baby Drivers and all that thing. I think that this really was a tentpole film that really like kicked him up a notch in terms of like prominency in what his name was, you know. And there are things sprinkled out throughout the entire movie that I'm just like, I really love. Like, when, you know, number one, like there's like this, there's a zero, on Scott Pilgrim's, you know, shirt. And it shows that, you know, oh, he's going to become a number two, you know, just like everybody else in Ramona's life. The color of his apparel changes, you know, over time with Ramona's hair, you know, symbolizing how like well in tune they are with each other. There's just like so many different things, so many different, like the different characters in this is a very textbook character representation, like how Knives represents Scott's insecurity, Envy Adams represents his past, how his super ego is within the confines of Ramona Flowers. I mean, it's just like how a lot of these characters represent different parts of, you know, the subconscious mind, and how like a lot of, and it just so happens to have a video game skin on it with the video game style, because he's, I think it goes deeper than that, because he treated life as a video game. He treated life as a game, you know, and it's very reflective on that, because of the video game nature of the film. He has a great, I don't know what his name is, but he's Macaulay Culkin's brother. And he played like, you know, the wisdom and the wise guy throughout the whole entire thing. The way he just like stood on the sidelines and like just like said, just like laughed at the entire situation. It was like entertained by everything going on. It kind of reminded me of you, Alexis.
Are you talking about? Oh, that was Macaulay Culkin's brother.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
okay.
The
roommate.
Yeah, the roommate.
Yeah, he was one of the few likable people I felt. I was like, okay, this guy doesn't give a shit. I like him.
There you go. That's why we're he like there's just a bunch of things going on with the whole entire movie. The cast is great. The exes, one of them is Superman. We have Mae Whitman, aka her, if you know Arrested
Development. Your girl Brie Larson was in here singing, no less. So I assume that was a moment for you.
Yeah. If only 2005 me could see this movie. My God. Plus, she sings a kick-ass song. I really love Black Sheep. And that's a really, really
cool. And she can really sing.
Yeah, she can really sing. I think in terms of casting, her casting made the most sense because she did have a pop career, previously to, you know, acting, she could sing, she could act the way that she had, like this over dramatic, you know, melodramatic kind of tone with her, like, what? No, like there. And I think that goes with like every character in the thing, but like hers especially, the way it's like overdone. I think that was like a nice little touch. I love the line where she says, you know, you should so totally come, and then Michael Cera was like, that's not gonna happen. It's just like little bits like that, little nuggets of like lines, mm-hmm. and like quick banter back and forth between characters.
I think also with this movie, there's a really, you can make a really wonderful case for an eye that Edgar Wright has for editing in general. Mm-hmm. The editing of this really makes the movie. I mean, in spades, with the quick cuts and just the outward and really unique identity in which he approaches how to cut this movie really helps, I think, sell home the overall final product.
Did you have favorite moments throughout the entire movie?
There were moments where that made me laugh, but not one that in the moment that makes me remember what it was.
Okay. I really like the moment where Knives rang the doorbell and like Michael didn't want to have to deal with that. George Michael. Yeah. George Michael. there was one moment in the thing where he just didn't want to deal with Knives. So he freaking crashed through the window. Yeah. Trying to run away.
That was funny.
There's just a bunch. There's a bunch. I really like Kim, played by Allison Pill's attitude towards everything. Like, you know, I used to date Scott in high school. And she's like, yeah, any stories? She's like, yeah, he's an idiot. Just like the brash dryness that she has is wonderful. She's a great character.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I will say, I think, I don't know. I really think this movie was just a... I really felt bad for Knives. She was just a punching bag throughout the entire movie. She's like Mantis in Guardians 2.
She was literally punched in the movie. So there, like, number one. But here's the thing: I had a complaint with Peter, and I talked with him, you know, behind the recording sessions.
Behind the shield.
Yeah.
Which just got a seventh season before a single episode airs of Behind the Shield.
Congratulations. Where's the champagne?
The campaign, by the way, I don't even know what I'm doing, but so far it's just
making it work. Some way, somehow. There was a question I had for Peter, and that was like, poor fuck, you know, Scott, and you know, why did you know, Knives, what was Knives, you know, point, like, Scott didn't deserve Knives and everything like that. And Peter made a point where he's like, that was the point of the thing. Because not only did Scott learn something at the end, but Knives learned something as well. While Scott learned to be less of a shitty person at the end, Knives learned self-respect at the end. Because
that's nice.
Because her own insecurities, you know, because she was a very insecure person before the end of the film, you know, because she said, you know.
Well, yeah, maybe because she was literally treated like shit.
Yeah. But then she had a line at the end. She's like, I'm too good for you anyway. And it, which is true. She's too good for Scott. And throughout the whole thing, I mean, there's just a bunch of character development that's really spot on and really gorgeously transitioned throughout the entire film. The character development in itself is like, you know, to be honest, I could go on forever talking about like how this worked and this worked and how like this made sense in this part and everything like that. Like different Easter eggs and everything like that, that, you know, it pointed out from A, B, and C, you know, there's just like that, you know, get to A to Z point in storytelling. And that, not only is there great, you know, written storytelling, but visual storytelling as well. It just made this, and you know, that's the reason why I love this movie so much, is that, you know, throughout the entire movie, I find more things to love about it. You know, I just, after every viewing, I love it more and more and more and more throughout the entire viewing experience. And I just, it's a movie that I go back to. And I just like, I remember why I love this movie to begin with. And yeah, I mean, it's just a multi-layered film, and I could definitely talk on about it. I mean, honestly, this podcast could be a 5-hour episode just talking about different layers of this film. But alas, so yeah. Final thoughts on Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I think it's a movie that will be beloved by this generation. I think, objectively speaking, it is a wonderful work of art. And I think Edgar Wright at his purest. Mm-hmm. And I celebrate a filmmaker being able the chance to make whatever movie he wants. And I definitely think, while I myself may not care for this movie all that much, it has my respect. And I do think that this type of movie needs to be championed, especially in the age of mediocre crap that we live in.
Okay. yeah. Did you like what you heard?
Cat got your tongue?
What was that? did you like what you heard here, ladies and gentlemen? And if you did, you could check out podcast.com, iTunes.com, and Google Play Music. And you could check out everything else on our sister programs, Fantasy Fair, with me and the ever-lovely Alexis Moreno. And you could check out more of Alexis Soto and Peter Martinez on Red Spotlight Entertainment. Coming soon with the Red Spot Entertainment, there's the Bohemian Rhapsody review that me and Alexis Moreno did. And then there's more stuff coming where we're going to be talking about Fantastic Beasts and other stuff. Alexis is going to take a victory lap talking about the renewal of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., a pre-renewal before season 6 even aired.
It's a Christmas miracle.
You gotta be real here. It's a fucking Christmas miracle.
And it's not even Christmas yet. So ladies and gentlemen, that would join us for other stuff on Red Spot Entertainment. Who knows what other
literally who knows? Every Tuesday on Tuesdays.
On Tuesdays, you know, talk about Doctor Who, so I think a lot of we're shaping up here on Red Spotlight Entertainment, ladies and gentlemen. So until next time, bye.